after the catastrophic disenfranchisement of voters in Georgia recently, and the hundreds of copycat bills across the country, I make the case why elections need to be federalized. H.R. 1 for the People Act of 2021 is a great start in that direction. Why would any political person, draped in a flag, shooting fireworks while F-18s fly overhead, want to make voting harder to do? Then I talk about seeing my favorite pro-union movie and the feels it gives me and the education about unions we all deserve. This is Secular Left. One of the political arguments that you're going to hear both sides supporting, the conclusion, is that our election system is broken. Of course, both sides don't come to the same conclusion using the same methods, but they do come to the same conclusion that our election system is broken. And I believe it. You'll have one side, such as the conservatives or Republican side, who want to make it tougher for people to vote. They claim that there's a lot of fraud, voter fraud, or that they want to protect the integrity of the election from massive voter fraud. And so they want to make it tougher for people, or at least put more obstacles in your way in order to vote, because they think that that is protecting the integrity of the election. On the other side, you have liberals and the Democrats who want to limit the amount of regulation there is on elections so that everybody has an opportunity to vote, no matter what your socioeconomic status is, no matter if you're disabled or not, what ethnic culture you're part of. They want to make it easy enough for you to vote. And so we have these two competing debates about it. The Democrats in the Congress last year introduced H.R. People First Act that was passed just this month. I don't think any Republicans voted for it, which isn't unusual. And what it would do is it would take care of the patchwork of state election regulations that we see. For example, in some states, if you fill out an absentee ballot, you have to go to the Board of Elections and fill out a form or an affidavit, and you have to show a positive ID, and you have to have a witness in order for them to accept the absentee ballot. Here in Ohio, it's no-fault absentee. That means if you request it, they'll send it to you, you fill it out, you send it back in. You don't have to have a witness, you don't have to go to the office, you just have to include your last four digits of your Social Security number or other methods of identification, and then they also compare your signature. And then you have other states like Oregon, which has a complete mail-in voting. So you have these different states doing different things. And so this H.R. 1 is an attempt to do away with these patchwork of state rules and make a common standard operating procedure for federal elections in no matter what state you live in. And I agree that that should be done. That is one of the reasons why the election system is broken, because of these different laws. And I think that the elections are so important because you're electing a president, you're electing Congress people, you're electing a senator. It's so important to the federal government that the elections have integrity and ease of use and protecting against fraud, and that the federal government needs to take over. They need to do away with, at least for federal elections, do away with having these patchwork of state rules. Now, of course, the Republicans are again. They don't like people voting because they can't win elections if all the people voted, as we noticed in 2020. So they want to make it harder. A couple things against Republicans' ideas. There is not widespread fraud in the election system. The lack or dismissal of the integrity of the election was all from the conservatives and from Republicans during the last election, led by the former president. telling the big lie about elections being stolen and fake ballots being counted, et cetera, et cetera. And these were, and some of these states where they are making these claims were states that were controlled by Republicans. And so you had Republicans defending their state election system against the national Republicans who were claiming that there was shenanigans going on. Another thing that I like about H.R. 1 is that it encourages states to develop voting systems that can be used in ranked choice voting. I'm a big proponent of ranked choice voting. I think that's one of the pillars of election reform. H.R. 1 is a pillar, ranked choice voting is a pillar, and ending gerrymandering is a pillar, which H.R. 1 also addresses is gerrymandering. Gerrymandering is when you configure congressional districts or election districts to benefit one party or another. So it would do away with that. The other thing that H.R. 1 does deals with is campaign finance. You have to be more transparent about the kind of money that you receive for a campaign and who donates to you. There's too much what they call dark money. This money given to a certain class of political action committees that don't have to disclose their donors. And so then you have millions of dollars going into elections and nobody knows why. Now, there is an argument that people have talked about that as part, and this is one of the things that they had, one of the court cases for Citizens United several years ago, was that it's a First Amendment right to donate campaign contributions to who you want. And so if that right is limited, then the government has to have a compelling interest. And I believe the government has a compelling interest. When you have somebody, let's say, just to pick on him, Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post and Amazon, and he is able to donate X amount of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars to a candidate. And then you have Joe Schmo, who is a constituent in that congressional district, and he donates $25. Who do you think that congressperson is going to listen to first? It's not going to be Joe Schmo. It's going to be Jeff Bezos. Money talks in Washington. You got to get the money, you got to curtail the power of money in Washington, D.C. And I believe that the H.R. 1 also talks about public financing of elections. That would do a lot to help. It would not only kind of level the playing field, but would also allow marginal groups to run candidates. Because, like I said, money talks and money is an issue about getting elected. You have to have a lot of money. One of the Republicans that is against the law, against the proposed law, is Frank LaRose, who's the Secretary of State of Ohio. Secretary of State in Ohio is the one that runs the elections each year. He believes that the election bill, H.R. 1, is not needed, that there's unfunded mandates included with it and unrealistic timelines. And I would probably respect what he has to say more if he didn't try to play both sides of the fence all the time. When he came into office, he talked a good game about election integrity and making sure you apply the rules equally to everybody. And then he started doing things like complaining about the number of drop boxes that a county can have. He instituted a directive, that's how they tell county boards of elections how to operate, a directive that there were to be only one drop box per county. And so what that means is that some people would have to travel, you know, dozens of miles sometimes to get to the drop box if they wanted to drop off their absentee ballot. And this became an issue in 2020 because you also had the other issue of the former president trying to dismantle the Postal Service, or at least hobble the Postal Service when they're considering talking about absentee ballots and mailing them in. And so the drop boxes became important because people wanted to avoid mailing them and possibly not getting them in time. And so they wanted to take them to a secure location where these drop boxes are. And Frank LaRose said you could only have one per county, even though the law said does not limit the number per county. He interpreted it himself. They even went to court, and the court said that the law does not say, but he ignored the court's order and only allowed one. He's also talked a good game about automated registration online, but currently, because H.R. 1 also talks about that, he's now against it. The other thing that H.R. 1 does is ask the states to mail out absentee ballot applications to every voter, even if they don't request one. You know, that's just common sense. You know, some people don't have time to request one. They don't have time. Like in Ohio, you have to download the form from the website, fill it out, and mail it in. You should be able to do that online. You should be able to request it online. You should be able to fill it out online. I think you should be able to vote online. But H.R. 1 starts that process. But Frank LaRose is also against that. And I get it. I mean, he is the grand poobah of elections in the state of Ohio, and he doesn't appreciate losing some of his privilege and giving it up to the federal government. But as I said, it's important that these elections, these federal elections where you're electing a president, a congressperson, a senator, that these be national elections, that we have a holiday for the election, that we have enough polling places, because that's another way that they do the polling, the voter suppression, is they've, since they had a lawsuit in 2013 that ruled part of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional, since that 2013, within 2 years, over 1,000 polling locations were closed, predominantly in minority neighborhoods, because they want to make it harder for black people to vote, for brown people to vote. And that Georgia law that was just passed this week prohibits voting on Sundays, early voting on Sundays, knowing that the black African-American churches in Georgia go to the polls on a Sunday together to vote. And that would be like telling a group of veterans at a VFW post that they can't go and vote at the same time. It's exactly the same thing, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to prohibit them from voting by making it onerous and making it difficult. You know, they don't put in the law black people can't vote, because that would be illegal. They just make it, they tailor the law language so that it only affects that one group, closing polls. Oh, the other thing was that they outlawed, the Georgia law outlawed giving people in line to vote snacks or water. In the law, they claim that that's a gift and that there's some kind of quid pro quo that somebody, let's say the Libertarian Party, comes out with some water and gives it to people. And they say, hey, you know, while you're in there voting, could you vote for this issue or could you vote for this candidate? That doesn't always happen. You know, there's boundaries around a voting place that you can't politic, but you can politic up to that point. So it's not, it's nothing unusual. And people don't normally see it as a compensation or a gift in order for them to vote one way. But the Republicans and conservatives have made it out to be that way. The other thing that they're against is called ballot harvesting, which is a made-up term where you nefariously collect multiple absentee ballots under the guise of turning them in for people, and you instead vote for however you want to vote for all these people, which doesn't really happen because, for example, in Ohio, the absentee ballots are in an envelope, a sealed envelope, inside another sealed envelope. And so it'd be pretty apparent if somebody opened the envelope before the election workers did. And if that happens, then that raises a red flag. The ID laws, the voter ID laws, would be done away with under H.R. 1. This is another voter suppression method, because you would force somebody that may not be able to afford an ID to have to buy one. Even if they gave them to them free, you would have to take your time, maybe take off work to go to a place, because you know it's going to be in one place clear across the county, and they're only going to be open a limited amount of time. Now, that's something similar to what Alabama did. They passed a strict voter ID law, and then they closed a bunch of license bureaus, so that it made it tougher for you to get an ID. Wisconsin did the same thing. The other thing that H.R. 1 does is it reinstates the previous part of the Voting Rights Act that was ruled unconstitutional. It's a formula to decide whether or not you have to get prior approval to change your voting laws. And as we can see, many of these states that have a history of voter suppression have gotten right back to it after pre-clearance from the federal government was done away with. Voter purges is another suppression method where you supposedly are supposed to clear out the voter rolls of people who have died or haven't voted in X amount of years, depending again on the state. And then what happens is sometimes they get bogus data and they delete perfectly eligible people from the voter rolls. And you don't find out until the day of election when you show up and you're not in the poll book. So you have to vote provisional and your vote may or may not count because they'll just say, well, you weren't registered to vote. The other thing that the Georgia law allows is easier voter challenging. See, that's another thing that's already in place to prevent fraud is you can have observers in a precinct polling place. Usually it's a Republican and a Democrat. They have to get credited through the state beforehand. And they observe the election process. And if they think that there is a voter who could be ineligible, they have the right to let the poll workers know that they think that that person is not eligible. So then that person fills out a provisional ballot if they haven't already voted. And they then have to have a hearing and go back and prove that they were eligible to vote to have their vote counted. So if you make it easier for them to challenge voters, you know what's going to happen. You're going to have a large group of conservative or Republican observers go into polling places in marginalized neighborhoods, such as African-American neighborhoods or Hispanic neighborhoods, and they're just going to wholesale challenge voters to try to suppress the vote. On the off chance that these people are not going to fight back or they're not going to try to get, you know, they're just going to give up. And that's the same with the closing the polling places. You create these very long lines where people have to stand for hours, which necessitates you getting snacks and drinks, obviously. And that's another way. See, it's not something that's obvious, but it does affect people in those marginalized groups. And I think it's un-American to have to stand in line for several hours in order to vote. It doesn't happen in the suburbs, I can tell you that much right now. It only tends to happen in minority neighborhoods and in minority communities. All of these voter suppression methods seem to impact the minority neighborhoods. And a rational person will see this, but yet we keep doing it. The Republicans and the conservatives keep doing it. So that's why I think that H.R. 1 is needed. So it's in the Senate now. Mitch McConnell is doing his usual flustering about that he's not going to allow a vote. He's going to filibuster it. And you got the Democrats saying, well, we're going to blow up the filibuster. You've got two more conservative members, Democrats, saying, no, you don't. You know, but this bill needs to pass. Frank LaRose needs to get on board because in order to protect the integrity of the elections, we need a single standard operating procedure for all the states to go by. And so check it out. I'm going to throw some links in the show notes to a fact check on it to tell you what's in an article about what's in the bill and the fact check that tells you what's not in the bill that people are talking about, and check it out. Hello, this is Doug, host of Secular Left, reminding you that I like to be validated. If you like this podcast and want to thank me, feel free to buy me a coffee. Go to buymeacoffee.com/secularleft and donate some cash to help make this a better show and validate me as a person. You'll feel better in the morning. Just the other day, I got ordered and received a Criterion Collection Blu-ray of the movie Matewan, which is one of my favorite movies. And it was distributed in 1987. It was directed by John Sayles. He's also the director of Eight Men Out, which is another good movie from that time period. And Matewan tells the story of union organizing in the coal fields of West Virginia in the 1920s. And if you check your history books, you'll find out that it was a very violent time in those areas. A lot of the miners who were trying to get a union together were veterans of World War I. So they were trained on how to use weapons. And a lot of times the struggle to get a union came to armed conflict. So much so that they have in some of the history textbooks, you read about the Battle of Blair Mountain. The state brought in the National Guard. The mining companies brought in their own goons. And it was a very violent time. People were indiscriminately killed, like mine officials were assassinated. Union officials were assassinated. Things like that. So it was a very, very violent time for people exercising their right to unionize. And a lot of people don't understand that that's what it used to be like. Back when the federal government didn't want unions, the state didn't want unions, the companies definitely did not want a union. And you still see some of that ambivalence about unions today, although the working conditions in the mines in the 1920s was very, very different than mining conditions today. In that, at least today, there's still some safety measures that are used. Back in the 1920s and before, that was it. You know, they didn't have a bunch of safety equipment, including the way that they mine. In modern day mining, they have these machines that get the coal out. They chunk the coal out and push it behind the machine onto hoppers, and then they're taken out of the mine. Well, in the 1920s, at least in particular in the Matewan area, all of the coal mining was dug by hand. You had miners with picks and shovels. A guy would come in and drill holes and put dynamite in it and blast a face of rock off. And then these other guys would come in with picks and shovels and put them in a horse-drawn cart to be taken out. It is very hard work, very back-breaking work. You could be killed. You could die from buildup of gases, methane gas. The roof of the mine could fall in on you at any time. It was just very dangerous. And they wanted to get some benefits from that. The other thing, too, is a lot of these mining companies owned the houses that the miners lived in. The miners could only shop at stores run by the company. And to make sure that that was done, they were given script instead of money that they could only spend at the company store. And so if you had any infractions, if you tried to get a union or if you were late to work too many times or if they just didn't want you anymore, they would bring some armed men in and set you out. They would evict you from the property. And you had no rights. You couldn't go to court or anything like that. The mining companies had carte blanche on how they treated their workers. So that's one of the reasons why they wanted to form a union, was to improve the working conditions and give themselves a little bit more rights that a union contract would do. So this movie I saw in 1987, or shortly after 1987 when it came out, in a staff development meeting at some place I was working at, which was weird that we were watching this union thing. And it has stuck with me all these years. Like I said, it's one of my favorite movies. It's really helped me form a lot of my viewpoint about unions. I was raised in a union household. I believe that unions are the best way for workers to collectively bargain with the managers of companies that they work at to get better benefits and safer working conditions. If you're able to have everybody leave a company and strike, that a lot of times that will get you what you want. And a lot of these companies allow the union. Some of them don't. Some of them actively work against it, such as Amazon. If you've been following the news, some Amazon order pickers in Alabama at their warehouse have been trying to organize. And I did, when I was in college, when I went to Ohio State, one of the classes I took was how to stop a union from coming in. It was in the business college, and I took it because I wanted to know some of the techniques that these companies use. And what they do is they hire these companies to do that today. They come in, they're like consultants, and they'll advise the company on what they need to do. One of the things that in today's market that they do is they divide the bargaining units. That's one way of suppressing a union. Unions want to have they want to cover an entire factory or business or wherever they're located at. They want all the workers to be in the union because that means that they're strongest. The company, though, wants you not to do that, and so they want to try to divide them up into different bargaining units. So you might have like customer service reps as one bargaining unit and truck drivers as another bargaining unit. And so the company will play them off of that. But anyway, so that's modern day. But back to Matewan. It's an excellent movie. Actor Chris Cooper, who you might recall was in the Jason Bourne movie, the first one, Bourne Identity, with Matt Damon. And he played the CIA officer who is the bad guy in that movie. The Matewan was his first major movie. The first Hollywood movie that he had done. Or it wasn't technically Hollywood. It was still independent. But it was one of his first major movies. Great actor. Love him in this. Because you actually believe that he could be... he plays the union organizer in this movie. There's another raft of unknown people that play parts. But then there's other people like Kevin Tai from Emergency. He plays a bad guy, which is interesting. One of the main characters is played by David Strathairn, who also was in the Jason Bourne movies. He played I can't remember his character's name. But he played the bad guy, CIA guy in Bourne Ultimatum. The cast also includes Mary McDonald, Gordon Clapp, who was on NYPD Blue, and Bob Gunton, who later on, 3 years later, played the warden in Shawshank Redemption. So, I mean, the cast is... Oh, and one of the most important ones was James Earl Jones, plays one of the black miners who's brought in to break the union. He's in the movie. And they just have a good cast. The cinematography is excellent. What I wanted to do right now is I wanted to play a... clip, the audio portion of a clip from Matewan. It's when Chris Cooper's union organizer is talking to the miners in a secret meeting about the union. And this scene occurs somewhat towards the beginning of the movie. But you kind of, this is the one thing, this is my favorite scene, and it's the one thing that really, really has stuck with me all these years. And gets to the heart of what it means to be in a union. So take a listen.
Union men, my ass. You want to be treated like men? You want to be treated fair? Well, you ain't men to that coal company. Your equipment, like a shovel, a gondola car, a hunk of wood brace. They'll use you. Till you wear out, or you break down, or you're buried under a slate fall, and then they'll get a new one. And they don't care what color it is or where it comes from. It doesn't matter how much coal you can load or how long your family has lived on this land. If you stand alone, you're just so much shit to those people. You think this man is your enemy? Huh? This is a worker. Any union keeps this man out ain't a union. It's a goddamn club. Now, they got you fighting white against colored, native against foreign, holla against holla. When you know there ain't but two sides of this world, them that work and them that don't. You work, they don't. That's all you got to know about the enemy. You say you got guns. Well, I know that you all are brave men. And I know you could shoot it out with the company if you had to. But the coal company don't want this union. The state government don't want it. The federal government don't want it. And they're all of them just waiting for an excuse to come down and crush us to nothing. Fellas, we're in a hole full of coal gas here. The tiniest spark at the wrong time is going to be the end of us. So we got to pick away at this situation, slow and careful. We got to organize and build support. We got to work together, together, till they can't get their coal out of the ground without us, because we're a union. Because we're the workers, damn it, and we take care of each other.
How can we shut the mines down if we don't dynamite them?
The men walk out. All of them.
Fat chance.
And every man that walks out on his own steam, we take into the union.
All the Dagos and all the colored?
That's what a union is, fellas. You better get used to it.
Yeah, but like I said, that is just one of my favorite scenes, you know, and especially when he talks about that there's two kinds of people. There's them that work and them that don't. You work, they don't. It just, oh, I just love that part. And I also like the part where he's pretty honest that, you know, these workers are treated nothing more than equipment. A lot of companies are like that. Labor costs are a line item on their books, and they don't care who you are. They don't care how long you've been with the company. They don't care about your production. This whole thing about a benevolent company taking care of you from until the grave, that's all a big, huge myth perpetrated by people who support capitalism. It doesn't exist. You know, especially as you've seen these people that are against paying a living wage. And like I tell friends of mine, you know, if you can't pay a living wage, then you don't need to be in business. You know, if it's so burdensome for you to pay your workers at least $15 an hour without going into bankruptcy, then something is wrong with your business model. It's as simple as that. And so that's why I really like this Mate Juan. The Criterion Collection, like I said, is excellent edition. Anything from Criterion Collection is really good. If you look for any, if you have favorite movies and you know, check out the Criterion Collection online and see if maybe they did an edition for your movie and get that, because some of the extras are excellent. The Mate Juan, they had a making of documentary that I hadn't seen. It was very good. So check it out. Mate Juan from 1987, directed by John Sayles.
Thank you for listening to this episode. You can check out more information, including links used in the show, in our notes page on our website, secularleft.us. Secular Left is hosted, written, and produced by Doug Berger, and he is entirely responsible for the content. Send us your comments and complaints using the contact form on our website or by email to comments@secularleft.us. Our theme music is Raving Energy by Kevin MacLeod from filmmusic.io, and licensed under Creative Commons using Attribution 4.0 International. See you next time.